This is a Word Balloon special report. From our news headquarters in Chicago, here's John Suntress.
Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today, a conversation with Vanita Rogers, reporter at Newsarama. She'll be joining me to discuss the current big picture subjects that are part of the current comics news cycle. The conversation centers around the management announcements made by DC Entertainment, but expands to include all of the comic publishers and how they're reacting to the burgeoning digital comics market. Plus, we talk about the slate of comic-based films to be released later this year. Word Balloon is brought to you by C2E2, the Chicago Comic and Entertainment Expo, this April 16th through the 18th. At McCormick Place in downtown Chicago. For the first time in over two decades, a national comics and entertainment convention is coming to downtown Chicago. Make your plans now to attend C2E2, April 16th through the 18th at McCormick Place. Join thousands of comic book fans, creators, and celebrities for a weekend of fun and excitement in the Windy City. Special guests for this year's show include Alex Ross, Jeff Smith, Jeff Johns, Mike Mignola, Gail Simone, Ethan Van Sciver, Ben Templesmith, plus more of your favorite creators. Tickets are only $25 for a one-day pass, $50 for the entire weekend. On Sunday, children 15 and under get in for free with an adult. For a full list of guests, events, and to purchase tickets, visit C2E2.com. But wait, there's more, because C2E2 and Word Balloon are giving you a chance to win tickets and exclusive C2E2 merchandise before the big weekend. We'll be giving away an amazing lunch with a Marvel editor, one VIP package, three weekend passes, five exclusive C2E2 posters signed by creator and guest of honor Alex Ross, and 15 limited edition C2E2 t-shirts. I've seen the posters. They're pretty amazing. Entering the contest is easy. Just visit C2E2.com/wordballoon and enter your name and email. That's all it takes. We'll be drawing winners from the entries on March 19th. Now stay tuned for more exciting news about the official C2E2 after-party plans and more ways to win tickets and exclusive merchandise by following C2E2 on Twitter. Right now, let's pick up our conversation with Vanita Rogers here on Word Balloon. And I'm just going to get started and say that we had an excellent response for our conversation about the Disney-Marvel merger.
Oh, really? Good.
Absolutely. No, a lot of people seem to enjoy the conversation, and we're facing another big news moment. It was something that we all anticipated in terms of positions that would be filled, but now we know the names. And you've had the opportunity to talk to a lot of these people or email interview. I'm not really sure. Did you talk to them on the phone, or did you have email interviews with these guys?
I did talk to them on the phone.
Did you talk to everyone? Did you talk to Diane Nelson as well?
I did not talk to Diane this time. I have talked to Diane, but I did not talk to her this time around. She wasn't there, but I talked to all the new executive staff, they call it. So, and I was surprised. I didn't know. I had understood that I was going to talk to John Rood and Jeff Johns and Jim Lee, and it was I was on speakerphone, and suddenly I heard this very familiar voice. Dan DiDio was in the room. You can do his
yes.
voice.
Hello, Vanita. Here I am.
Yeah, exactly.
Look at me. Now I'm sitting here sharing a chair with Jim. That's great.
Exactly. So, yeah, I got to talk to the four new executives.
Okay, and, now we know the big three, and the big, that right on top we've got Jim Lee and Dan DiDio, co-publishers, Jeff Johns, creative... Chief Creative Officer.
Uh-huh.
And then John Rood. First, let's talk about John Rood, because he's the one I think comic fans know the least about. And reading the coverage that I've read, it was interesting to note that he's been working for ABC Family, which should make a lot of comic fans excited, given their attention that they've paid to the science fiction genre in a lot of their new shows that they've been targeting to tweens and young teens.
Well, I think that my impression of him, and again, very, very, very brief interview, and it was a room, I was on speakerphone, but my impression of him was he's very knowledgeable about the entertainment business in general, and much more knowledgeable about the comic book business than I even expected. And really, the excitement that I felt from him was palpable. It was mm-hmm. very... I was surprised to hear from him as much as I did, and I'm not sure. I haven't had a chance to look at anybody else who talked to them, but I He really seemed to have a very clear idea of the direction that Diane had for DC Entertainment, and had an understanding of what role Jeff was playing, what role the publishers were playing, what my reading audience was concerned about. He seemed to really understand the whole business, which, you know, when you hear someone coming from television, you can't help it. When you're in the comic book business, you kind of go, oh yeah, one of those TV guys. But I got a real indication from him that he understands this business, and you know, we'll see what happens. And from what Jim Lee said, he's going to be working directly with him on the next steps in what they do in the digital realm, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But
absolutely,
so I think he's going to take an active role in that, as well as, you know, the marketing and coordination with Warner Brothers. So I think he's more of an instrumental player than probably is indicated by the attention that us comic fans are giving to this team. I think we're all like, wow, Jim Lee and Jeff Johns are part of the
yeah.
team. But I think John Rood's going to be a pretty important player on that team.
And given his experience in marketing through mobile phones and online, and the things that he did do for ABC Family, and his past relationship with Diane Nelson as well, I think speaks well for what he's bringing to the equation. And then, as you say, he is a comics fan. And that's what I think is neat. Going back, you know, 25 years to when, and maybe it was a little bit longer, but when Jeanette Kahn came in, if you look back at that period, there was a lot of creative energy that was really put forward by DC, and a lot of big deals happened with Jeanette Kahn taking over and Dick Giordano. And I kind of see this Nelson, DiDio, Jim Lee, Johns, etc. relationship in the same way that an outsider is heading things, but is sticking with a creative team that does know the comic book business, but also is, you know, interested in pursuing new ideas and changing the way business gets done.
I think if you look at these guys too, they're not foreigners to the areas that they're going to be working in.
Right.
I mean, they have experience in those areas. They aren't from those areas. They're from comics. I mean, most of them, or have been working in comics for a while. But I think most people, you know, recognize that she really made an effort to stick with people who not only have experience in the other media that the comics, they want to explore these other media, but she also wanted, you know, people with experience in comics and who understand the comic book business.
Have you had a chance yet to see the new direct-to-video Crisis on Two Earths?
No, I haven't.
I got to tell you, it seems to me that since that initiative, and even things like John's writing the Smallville episode, the comic book writers that have written on Justice League Unlimited and the previous incarnations, and I just had the Batman Brave and Bold producers on, it really seems like the people that are coming from Warner Brothers get it and want the properties that are outside of comic books to be as representative of the source material as possible, and are doing a great job. And I'll tell you, this sleeper feature on the new direct-to-DVD video is that Spectre short, because it is exactly what made the 70s Spectre great. It totally feels like that Jim Aparo, Mike Fleischer adventure comic series. And, you know, Ostrander and all the great creators that have touched the Spectre since all kind of harken back to that, you know, template of what made the Spectre great. So I think this is all great. Again, the Smallville episode turned out fantastic. Given the budget constraints that they had, I thought it was a really good episode. And the fact that they gave Jeff this two-hour movie during sweeps, you know, they handed the show over to a comic book guy. It seems if there was ever a time that they ignored the comic book side, they get it. They see the success of Dark Knight and everything else. They want more of it, and that's why these guys were selected.
Right, definitely. I agree. I mean, I think that they have a recognition that not only do they want to have some type of overall, their characters, they want to have an overall image for their characters that it carries over from the comic books to the television series to the movies, and it all kind of matches. They're protecting their licensed properties mm-hmm. for not only our generation. I mean, I'm putting myself right there with you, the older generation.
Sure.
Who has grown up with comic books and were comic book fans, but also the younger generations that are growing up with these, like you mentioned, Justice League Unlimited. This generation, they want them growing up with these characters and a knowledge of these characters that has been around for years, has been proven for years, and will be proven for years to come. So you don't mess around with it. You know, you don't mess around with that image. And when you do, you have disastrous results. I think, you know, we can point to several characters who have gone through that, and you just don't want to mess with them. These are their, you know, their diamonds, their cash cows. So they want to protect them, and they've caught on who the right people are to protect them, and it is the comic book guys who know them the best.
You can't help but, you know, compare the timing of all the activity with Disney and Marvel. Did Disney Marvel come up at all in the conference call that you had with these people?
No, but you know, you get the feeling that it's been an evolution of many years, and mm-hmm. I think a lot of people point toward Marvel making their own movies.
Sure.
Marvel Studios being a huge turning point where the power kind of was handed back to the comic book side, or at least maybe not the power, but the respect. And, gee, maybe we should involve them. Look, Marvel did that. And so I think it's less, honestly, this is my opinion. Again, it really did. It didn't come up. But I think it's less about Disney buying Marvel. I think the reason Disney bought Marvel is because of Marvel started making its own movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the reason that Warner Brothers started taking more seriously the coordination between comics and movies and TV and everything is because Marvel had started making their own movies. I mean, I think it really comes down to that decision and obviously that success. They had a success with it, and I think that is just a huge turning point in Hollywood and comics, and I think it's certainly important in the scheme of things that Disney now owns Marvel, but I think DC Entertainment was in the works long before that.
I would agree, and I also think that, you know, the success of the same year, you know, 2008 is going to be this watershed year for Disney. You know, for Marvel, it was obviously Iron Man, and, you know, the $1 billion that Dark Knight made for DC, and again, you point to the fact that they had comic book people involved in that movie. David Goyer was right there, and you know, and they threw so many comic book things into that movie. I think you're right. I think these are all win-wins, and we'll see what happens next.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of guesses on what will happen next. Obviously, getting away from the DC conversation, which I know is supposed to be our focus here, but I think, you know, there's a lot of opportunities for smaller publishers at this point.
Sure.
Where Warner Brothers is a big studio and is going to do big movies, and Marvel is certainly looking in that direction as well. I think that the smaller comic book companies, there's a lot of opportunities when there's successes for things like Kick-Ass or mm-hmm. Wanted, although they changed Wanted quite a bit, but coming up with Scott Pilgrim, which I think is going to surprise a lot of people.
I think you're right.
You know, there's a lot of comic books that are being made into movies now that wouldn't have even gotten a second look probably 5 or 10 years ago. But I think I did a story on this. There's 10 comic book movies this year.
Yeah.
It's just incredible how many, and a lot of them are the big movies for this year. So I think, you know, going down the line, what Marvel has opened by Marvel Studios doing their own movies, I think going down the road, there's a couple of things that they've opened the door for comic book movies in general and a respect for comic book movies. I think that they are just now opening the door for shared universes, and I think that DC Entertainment is that's part of what Jeff will be doing, is setting up some type of, again, this is a guess, nobody has told me this, but I think it's clear that DC wants to do the same kind of thing. We've heard quotes from people at Warner Brothers indicating that Green Lantern, the movie, wants to have, for example, a Superman cameo or something in there to indicate that this is a shared universe with other DC characters. Mm-hmm. So that's coming down the line. I think there's a possibility for comic book companies, other comic book companies, to make their own movies, which doesn't sound like it could happen, but down the road it could. You know, the further you get into studios or comic book companies having money behind them and having investors and getting their own productions together, they could be the ones making these movies similar to what Marvel Studios did, but on a smaller scale.
Well, and
it has opened the door for so much for comic books. It's really pretty exciting. But again, I'm getting off the track from DC Entertainment. But DC Entertainment is just one part of, you know, the possibilities for comic books and Hollywood, the synergy there.
Well, they have the structure behind them as opposed to making a deal with a studio. They've got the entire, you know, everything's there for Time Warner. This is just, you know, one division talking to another and seeing the potential that's there. But you're right, and we've kind of seen it already in this last year, 2009, with The Surrogates being made. And I finally saw The Surrogates, by the way, and I thought it was a better movie than it ever got credit for. Did you see it?
I enjoyed it too. Yeah. It was good, and it's a great thing to point to. I kind of wish more people had seen it and that it had done better in the box office, because it's perfect to point to as an example of a comic book movie that isn't superheroes, but really it had a lot of flavor to it that you think of as, you know, comic book movie. You know?
Sure. Well, and back to DC, everyone is, you know, feeling sorry for Karen Berger that she's not more part of the changes. But as we look ahead and see what happens this summer, man, I got to tell you, that Losers trailer looks fantastic. And I can't believe that if the Losers has good success in the box office, that, you know, they are going to look at the Vertigo properties. And I know that I've seen in your article and subsequent articles that have covered comments from Nelson and company that, you know, everyone keeps assuring the public that Vertigo is certainly part of the picture, just as Wildstorm is, and that really this creative team, much like the Marvel creative team, it seems, the guys that do meet with the Hollywood producers and directors are looking at all properties that fall under DC, and that includes Wildstorm and Vertigo. So we aren't going to just see superhero films. And I really think The Losers is a great film to start with, and maybe, you know, let us forget about a couple of the missteps that happened. You know, Constantine should have been a better movie. It was okay, unless you actually read the comic book, and then maybe you were disappointed. The Losers sure looks like the same book that I liked 10 years ago. I don't know how you feel about it.
Yeah, I think the trailer looks fabulous. I think I love every single trailer I've seen for just about every comic book movie this year. But yeah, Losers looks better, honestly, than I expected.
Yeah, me too.
But yeah, the trailer was great. And Kick-Ass, again,
yeah.
So much. I mean, I thought, oh, they're going to turn that into a movie. I mean, I'll be honest, you know. I mean, I like the comic book, but, you know, it's like, oh, my God. The trailer is just, oh, just rolling over laughing, and it's great. But yeah, as far as Vertigo goes, you know, I think with Vertigo and Hollywood and the relationship there is much more about the stories. Not to say that they can't make action figures out of Vertigo properties, or they can't make, you know, eventual television shows or whatever. But I think it's a different mindset with Vertigo than it is with the key DC characters.
Licensing the characters and making them available for everything.
Exactly. I mean, when you've got a Batman and a Spider-Man, there's just so much potential for that character in toys and video games and multiple movies and TV shows, and, you know, just keep go on and on and on. And while there's certainly opportunities for other media to take Vertigo stories and expand upon them or you know, have them on the silver screen. It's a little bit different situation, I think. And I think that's why Vertigo hasn't gotten attention in this DC Entertainment move, because I think the whole, you know, inertia behind forming DC Entertainment is driven by those characters. And see, again, I really do think it's because Marvel Studios started making its own movies and started having success, coupled with obviously the Batman success. But seeing that a company like Marvel can take their characters, even somebody unknown like Iron Man, and can have so much success with them, why DC is saying, you know, why aren't we doing that? Why aren't we? I mean, quite frankly, you know, Batman is a whole lot more recognizable than Iron Man, Superman. You know, there's so many properties that they have, Wonder Woman, and they just weren't being developed. And I think there's a real push there toward making this happen. And they weren't communicating effectively. They weren't working together, East Coast and West Coast, and now they are. So,
well, let's talk.
Yeah, I think it's those characters. Now that said, definitely the Vertigo line and the future of publishing. Really, I mean, a lot of the question marks about comic books is what is the future with the iPad and with digital comics. And I thought it was really interesting. I honestly, if you did read my article, you probably thought, oh, Vanita must have asked him about the iPad. I did not ask Jim Lee about the iPad. He brought it up, and then that's when we talked about it. He brought it up, so it's obviously something that, you know, he's interested in, and digital comics is obviously something both Marvel and DC are interested in, and really all comic publishers are putting out their feelers in every place they can to try and figure out what the future is there. And really, the future of comic books, there's kind of a question mark about it. But the one thing that I think everybody knows is there will always be a place for bookstore books that are more like graphic novels. And I think that that's where Vertigo has had the greatest amount of success under the DC banner, is that they do very well in collections. And a lot of times are positioned that way. So if there's a future for comic books in bookstores, I think Vertigo is, you know, a really powerful way for DC to still have that foothold in a way that a lot of other major publishers don't really have that.
Let's talk about the digital market for a second, because DC established an arm of it with Zuda. And did Zuda figure into the conversation at all? I mean, I know that Jim has been very vocal about the future of digital and what he and Root are going to look at. But, you know, was the structure of Zuda even mentioned? Because to me, it seems like they've already got a basic marketplace. The only thing that's missing is a paywall. And that's something that can cross platforms. Because that's my fear about the iPad. I mean, I think the iPad's this wonderful thing, but I also think that it is a typical Apple product that, at least on the surface, is really, you know, forcing you into an exclusive system rather than a multi-platform system that could, you know, a bunch of devices can, you know, capitalize on. iTunes obviously modified itself and became more MP3 friendly to everybody. But, you know, I mean, it really was Apple first and foremost. And I wonder if, you know, the iPad is, you know, being looked at too quickly as a cure-all. I know other pads are coming and other tablet computers, but you tell me.
Well, I think that I see what you're saying. You're saying, well, you can't, you know, just sell a PDF. Well, not that you could probably do that anyway, because you would want it protected somehow. But I think that the delivery method is less. The delivery method is probably less important than just getting something into people's hands that is conducive to looking at comic books. I think that digital books were not successful on computers because it just isn't the kind of thing that you can, you know, hold in your hands and take places with you and read a book. You know, you can't lay in bed with your tower and your monitor, you know, and read a book, but you can with your Kindle. And I think that the ebook market just exploded with the Kindle. Amazon reported, you know, they sold more ebooks during the holiday season than they did actual paper books, printed books. So it just, it really took off with that. And I think what's exciting about the iPad and why Jim Lee would bring that up, but bring it up saying, you know, we don't know how well this thing is going to sell because there's a lot of things they don't know. But I think what's exciting about the iPad is that not so much the delivery method that it's offering to comics, but more that it is a way to view comics digitally that would work with comic books. And then it would open the door for other color ebook readers or multimedia readers. Mm-hmm. It's not even really an ebook reader, it's a multimedia tablet. And it would open the door for more of those. People aren't going to fork out the money for those until you have a product that really everybody's got one, and I got to have one, you know. And maybe I don't want an iPad because I'm not really into Apple, but Sony just came out with this or whatever.
Sure.
And in that case, I would think that any publisher would be able to offer their publication on those multiple platforms, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I mean, it's certainly there's ways to, like, I can read Kindle books on my iPhone, for example,
right,
my Kindle app. So I think that there's ways that if you decide, okay, we're going to sell our books through, our comics through the iBook store, those are also, you know, they're working with Amazon on those, and I would think that there would be a way, even if it comes down the line like it did, as you mentioned, with music, but there would be a way that you could buy from iBook store on other
tablets.
Tablets or computer or whatever. Right now, Comics by Comixology is the leading application for reading more than one type of comic book. In other words, at any given time, if somebody releases a comic book as an app, it might be the leading app. But Comics by Comixology offers, you know, tons of comics every week, hundreds of comics. And they're putting together a web application where if you have an account on the iPhone, you can also read your comics on the web if you just log in and mm-hmm. you have your digital comics. And then their plan is to also, if you have an app, you know, the app on your iPhone, you can also read your comics on the iPad. So granted, you know, those are two Apple products that I'm mentioning, but you can also read it on the web. And I would think that down the line, if this becomes popular enough, and if there are, you know, other products out there, those comics would be accessible on other tablets or computers or whatever device people come up with.
Sure.
Who knows what's going to come down the road.
Well, and it's fair to mention that unlike Marvel and DC, publishers like IDW that have big licenses in the Transformers and the Star Trek books are already embracing digital comics and having good success with them. Dark Horse is doing it with some of the Star Wars books as well. So, and we mentioned, you know, the Apple products. PlayStation is a player as well, and I just had
right.
Ben Templesmith on, and he was talking about commentaries that he and Chris Ryle just did for Groom Lake for the PSP. So
there's so much that, you know, and that's one of the things that I brought up with John Rood when I talked to him, was the future of comics. When you start talking about this multimedia idea behind DC Entertainment, and you're taking, like, their goal is to take, for example, Green Lantern and make him one of the most recognizable characters across multiple platforms,
mm-hmm.
right? So, and that's great. I think all Green Lantern fans think that's terrific. But somewhere in there, those of us who are comic book fans and maybe even comic book snobs, which I try not to be, but at times I am, right? But you recognize the art form of comics is getting lost somewhere in there. You know, you start thinking, wait a minute, DC is a comic book company, but it's becoming something else. It's like Marvel, we think of it as a comic book company, but, you know, that's the vast majority of people who are exposed to Spider-Man and know Spider-Man stories have never read a comic in their life. So
sure.
At what point does DC, and I specifically put that question to John Rood and said, you know, at what point are you not, you're the marketing guy, are you marketing comics? Are you marketing properties? And, you know, where do comics fall? I mean, there is an art form to it. Granted, it's evolved over the years. You know, the 35 issues it took for Bucky to put on the Captain America uniform, you know, there's no way 4 years ago it would have taken him 35 issues. It would have taken him, you know, half an issue maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
But, so it's evolved over the years, but there's still an art form there that you can't help but wonder if it's going to get lost in all this synergy. Certainly watching those motion comics, you know, there's very little left of the comic book art form there, you know. And, I mean, as much as you love seeing the story from the comic book and you love seeing the artwork from the comic book, the sequential storytelling, even the chapters, the cliffhangers, you know, a lot of times are eliminated in that. And
sure.
there's a completely different feel to them in
oh, yeah.
the cartoons, and you know what I'm saying?
I do.
So, but his answer, John Rood, was, well, look at who we have in place. You know, look at who we put in charge here. It's Geoff Johns and Jim Lee, and these people don't want comics to go away.
Absolutely.
But I can't help thinking as a fan, you know, it's kind of a weird thing. You do want everybody to know who Green Lantern is. We're all excited. Oh, my gosh, this is so great. I can actually talk to other people about Green Lantern. But I don't know, somewhere in there I can't help thinking, you know, but come over here and read this thing and see how cool it is to have to wait a month for the next issue.
No, I hear you. But to their credit, they've already done examples of that, because all you have to do is look at last year's Green Lantern animated DVD, and the bonus feature is, you know, Johns and DiDio talking up Blackest Night. And
and I come from that. I mean, as I told you, the way I started reading comics is I watched the Daredevil DVD, and I literally watched the commentaries. And Kevin Smith was talking about this comic book he wrote. And I said, wow, I didn't know Kevin Smith wrote comics. I mean, I was completely ignorant of that world and picked up a comic book for the first time. So, yes, the hope would be that you would, you know, open up this pathway for people to come and pick up a comic. So, I mean, I think that's, you know, as long as you keep that in mind.
Sure. Well, you know, what I think will be an interesting development will be to see if, you know, how many times do you hear comic fans watch either a comic-based television show or a comic-based film and say, God, couldn't they just put in a little commercial that says, hey, if you like this, you know, go to your comic book store and check it out every month. And, you know, God, even the George Reeves Superman literally has it in the closing credits, not only in print, but the narrator actually says Superman is featured in Action and Superman magazines. But again, I point to the DVDs and say they're doing it there. You know, they've done it with every direct-to-DV animated feature that they've made, where, you know, a big kiss to the comic books. Superman Doomsday, the best thing about that DVD was the history of the comic book version of the death of Superman. And,
right.
You know, I mean, this, you know, as detailed as the Daredevil one
well,
was.
Well, says you, that was the best part. I bet my kids go, Mom, boring.
That's a good point.
No, but I understand what you're saying. And I, you know what? I would hope that that's part of the synergy that DC Entertainment wants to have. And I can't imagine it's not with, again, Jim Lee and Geoff Johns and there, and even John Rood and his answers to me about the you know, how much they respect and want to make the comic book art form part of what happens in Hollywood. So I can't help but think that this actually is good for that, that there will be more DVD commentaries. And
sure.
And that when, you know, when Batman Begins or The Dark Knight are made into some kind of a, I don't know, an interactive app on the iPad, that you also have, you know, a comic book at the end, or I don't know. So, you know, I would think that this synergy is only good for that. But I think that's, you know, that's what's so wild about this whole idea of Hollywood's interest in comic books over the last it was your show where I first got the idea to start doing these movie articles when you guys were talking about Blade being the beginning of it all, but it really kicking up with X-Men over the last 10 years.
And that's right.
I just think one of the things that has happened is that, comics are movies, are video games, are television shows, are comics. I mean, it's all kind of bleeding together, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, you know, because it does lead people who watch movies now to comics and people who read comics to movies. It's all working together, and that's the fact that the businesses are reflecting that. It's kind of driven by what the audience is responding to, and it just makes sense for DC Entertainment to do this.
And also look at how both the big two are not letting opportunities go away. And unlike 10 years ago when the first X-Men movie came out in 11 years ago now, 99, they were really unprepared from a comic book standpoint to exploit the success at the box office with new material. We're certainly seeing a ton of Iron Man material be put out there in comic form, and it will all be collected in time for the Iron Man movie. By the same token, DC is doing that not only, again, in comics, but I noticed that the next bonus feature in the next direct-to-DVD animated film will be a Jonah Hex animated short, which will be in time to tease the movie.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, that's the great thing. I think both companies, you know, finally get it. Rucka years ago in my first conversation with him said DC and Marvel are like the tortoise and the hare. And Marvel, because at the time it was an independent company, was much more nimble and could react to the market faster, make changes and things. But every now and then they would kind of smack into a wall. And then here comes DC, the tortoise, you know, slow and steady, and suddenly they pull ahead for a little while, and suddenly they seem to have the fresh ideas. And maybe we saw that a bit with Blackest Night and the, you know, success that it had, which I'm sure had to figure into Nelson's tapping Johns for what's going on. Let's get back to the four, and we've talked about John Root's position, but let's talk about the other three, the ones that comic fans know. Everyone wants to know about this co-publishing thing. I've worked at radio stations where they've had co-program directors, and sometimes it's worked out, and sometimes it's been, you know, loggerheads and, you know, guys clashing and stuff like that. You know, we won't know until we start seeing some things in action, but, you know, what were you able to glean in terms of how responsibilities will be, you know, divided up?
Well, I think it was interesting. Right from the start, I asked Jim Lee what his responsibilities would be, and I don't think any of them wanted to get into details, but one of the things he said was that Dan would still do the day-to-day stuff in editorial. And the day-to-day stuff, you know, in the New York offices. And I really think that while Jim will be very much involved in the big decisions on editorial, I think Jim's going to be more responsible for things that are on the West Coast. And in particular, at least for now, I think that he really is taking a lead role, and he has said that he's taking a lead role in this, in exploring the future of digital comics for DC.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that because he's on the West Coast, and I think they came right out and they said one of the reasons we did a co-publisher was to further promote the synergy between the West Coast and the East Coast offices, and Dan's in New York, and Jim's in California, and I think that the responsibilities will be divided up somewhat in that manner. I think there'll still be tons of coordination between the two of them, but neither of them said, oh, well, we're going to split the responsibilities right in half, and I'm going to do stuff in, you know, the publishing side, and Jim's going to do stuff on the Hollywood side. But I think it is just going to naturally flow that way to some extent, simply because of the locations. Because Jim even said that he's going to be working with John in Burbank on the digital stuff, you know, and he specifically said that Dan's going to be doing the day-to-day stuff in New York. So I think that it does divide up somewhat, but keep in mind that Dan will no longer be as much of a hands-on editor as he used to be. There is going to be some role under him, whether it's, you know, EIC or executive editor or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
He's now publisher, so it won't be hands-on editorial stuff as much as it used to be, but I think it will be more of a role in that for him than what Jim's doing. And again, I'm just kind of saying what I gleaned from those conversations, which were very brief. So, you know, I could end up being completely wrong, but that's kind of what I gathered and what seems to make the most sense from what they said about the reason we have co-publishers is to promote this synergy between the East Coast and the West Coast, and the fact that they are located in the East Coast and the West Coast. So I think it has more to do with that.
Well, as far as the publishing side, it'll be interesting, and I think it might manifest itself at conventions, because how DC Nation and things run. And not so much from me expecting to hear more from Jim Lee, although I'm sure we will. But I also wonder who is going to be under these guys. Is Johns's position above the editors? I mean, is that what we're to gather
from?
I
don't think it is, but I think if you saw a flow chart, it would. I think he reports directly to the publishers. I don't think, not in his writing capabilities, mind you, because I'm sure he'll still have editors.
Sure.
And he'll still work within that realm. But for his CCO, which I mm-hmm. love that.
Yeah, I know.
CCO responsibilities, I think the flow chart would show him right up there. With a line, kind of a dotted line to the publishers and to the executive vice presidents, to John Rood and to, you know, it would be the executive team. There'd be like a little dotted square line around them.
Have you had a chance?
As opposed to him reporting to an editor in the things that he's doing there, because I don't think that the person who's going to be the new executive editor is going to be concerned in any way, shape, or form with what Jeff's doing looking at the Green Lantern script or
right.
what they're doing on Smallville or that kind of thing. So he would report more directly to Diane and the executive team.
Have you had a chance to talk to Jeff directly yet?
No, I haven't.
Because a lot of what his duties sound like remind me of what Bendis does in Marvel without the title.
It totally does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I don't think he's doing exactly that, because I think the way Marvel kind of has his position set up is as kind of a consultant on the movies. But I think Jeff's going to be involved in a lot more than just movies.
Right.
Because he talked toys and video games, and I mean, I think he's going to be like, I am the DC character expert for all this stuff you guys are doing.
That's
Whereas
a good job.
I didn't get the feeling. Yeah, no doubt. But really, I mean, think about it. Who at DC would... I mean, okay, I'm going to show my bias here, but who at DC would be better at it? I mean, Jeff knows these characters so well. You know what I mean?
No.
We even talked about the guys who did 52. They all admit, you know, they all turned to him for continuity stuff. I mean, he knew these characters like the back of his hand. I think half his brain actually lives in the DC universe. I think it exists there.
I think the majority of DC fans would agree with the two of us, because we're both John's fans as well, and we like him for that reason. He does know the history. He's able to take continuity and make it work and make it fresh for new readers, but make old readers like myself happy that he remembers this stuff and is able to put a new spin on things.
Yeah, it's like less of... I even hate to use the word continuity, because it's more like essence.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yes, I do.
Essence of that character. Like he knows the continuity, and he knows, you know, their costume, and he knows every iteration of the word Hawkman in comic books in history, you know? But he can boil it down to just this one little, this is the essence of this character. You know, I remember I did an interview with him where he stated the essence of Hawkman in a sentence, you know, and that was it. And you had it, and he put it in Smallville. So, you know, he can take these characters, and he understands them. So I think that, but he would also recognize things in Smallville or a movie or a video game that would not match up with continuity and or the essence of the character.
Yeah,
and I think that's really what his job is pretty much going to be. I mean, it certainly sounded like that to me when he described it.
That's
but
cool.
He's still going to write, which is
very cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing. I think fans were really happy when they heard about that. You know, Jeff's involvement and what he'd be doing. Their first fear was, you know, what does this mean in terms of him writing? But it does sound like he still has a pretty full plate as far as scripting goes.
Right. I think a lot of what he's doing now, he was already doing and just not getting recognized.
I think you're right. Actually, you're in the better position to know that as well. I've already said that on a couple other podcasts where, you know, I point out it's like, you know, Jeff doesn't like to brag about it, but he has been writing film treatments for a lot.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's basically like the co-writer of the Flash film, and he came up with the treatment for the film. At what stage that is, I don't know. I don't want to pretend like they're going forward and that's going to be the film. But he did, you know, work on that, and I know that they had, you know, they've had some comic book creators involved in that, and he was very involved in that. And as he stated, you know, he did look over the Green Lantern script, and I think he's been much more involved than any of us knew, but just was never given any official title. And it was more, I think, Warner Brothers recognizing that they probably ought to have someone at DC look this over and just saying, who could we have look this over kind of thing, or who could come up with these treatments? And there was never really an official person who did that, and Jeff's going to be that official person now. And I think it's terrific that, you know, he's being recognized for something he's been doing for a while. And there's some things that probably weren't being run by someone like that now definitely will.
Very cool. And I, back to who was going to be the editors, it sounds like they are kind of reviewing all the editors as well, and we might see another editorial shakeup.
I think there's no question. I think there's no question we'll see an editorial shakeup. I mean, that again, my opinion, but even the way it sounded, you know, I came right out, and I think they were very surprised, just between you and me, the internet. I think they were a little surprised when I said, so who's taking your old job, Dan? I don't know that anybody else had asked him that, because there was a bit of silence, and then I heard a little whispering. So, but, and then I don't remember what the exact quote was, but it was, well, right now we're concentrating on, you know, the executive team, and then we'll kind of go down from there. I do, and we're looking at all the positions in editorial. I have a feeling that there'll be, you know, no fear.
I'm going to give you your own quote here. According to DiDio, right now this is about setting up the executive team. At this particular time, that's where our focus is. In the course of time and over the next month, we'll be reviewing the staff and how we fill the position of the executive editor going forward. We have such incredible talent at the top of the masthead now with Jim and Jeff, and it's important to figure out how we fill out from there. Because, yeah, I think, you know, I just talked to John Hickman about a month ago, and he made a very interesting point about Marvel in saying there is no midline group of titles at Marvel, that there really is this, you know, every book has to hit a certain number, and if it doesn't do it, then the book gets canceled. And we see that a lot quicker at Marvel than we do at DC. And I think this is a DC strength, and certainly their plan to develop these properties, I think books will be given a little bit more shelf life. Maybe that will change with Disney, and maybe they will be given that same thing with Marvel. But as it stands now, it always seems like DC was more willing to stick with the book. And Jim was doing that at Wildstorm as well. Sleeper was a perfect example of that. Ed Brubaker's book, critically acclaimed, struggled through its first 12 issues, and Jim Lee comes out and says, yeah, listen, I know it didn't sell that well. We're still going to give it another year because Ed wants to tell this story, and I think it's a great book. It'll be interesting to see what changes are made and, again, what kind of influence this creative team can have to help, you know, bring the ship up from a mid-title standpoint and see how the Aquamans and the Hawkmans and the Martian Manhunters and all those mid-length, you know, titles that, you know, fans love, but, you know, they seem to have trouble, you know, really keeping traction and keeping a regular monthly book going.
Well, and I hate to go back to this, but I have, you know, a lot of excitement for this part of what's going to happen, but there's a lot of possibility for those things if digital comics take off.
Yes.
You know, I actually just looked at numbers for, like, Great 10. I think right now is, you know, it's not going to become an ongoing, clearly. It's not doing great. It's doing okay, but it's not doing, you know, it's not the kind of thing that's going to stick around. And a 10-issue Great 10 miniseries, it would just why not on the iPad or wherever, you know? So I think if they do go down the avenue of really being aggressive in digital comics, that would open up a lot of opportunity. These co-features, that I think a lot of people enjoy the co-features. They don't like the higher, you know, price, obviously, and I can understand that. But they like that these characters are getting a little bit more of a spotlight. I mean, it just opens up a world of possibility if digital comics take off. And I think that one of the things I do like about the co-publisher situation and Jim Lee looking so closely at digital comics is that there does seem to be an equal amount of importance and a thought behind coordinating between the print comics and the digital comics. If they truly are somewhat divided, the co-publishers are divided by, well, one guy's doing a little bit more on print and one guy's doing a little bit more on digital. The fact that they have an equal title and that they're going to be working so much in conjunction, you know, it points toward the digital comics really working in synergy with the print comics.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's some excitement down the road there. I mean, again, it all depends on whether people pick up iPads or whatever it is that we can actually read digital comics on and feel like we're reading a comic. Whether or not that takes off.
They're going to have to.
If it does, I think it's kind of exciting that they're thinking ahead of time, hey, let's give these guys who are in charge of these things equal importance, and let's make sure that the print works with the digital and works together.
They're going to have to risk something, too, because I can appreciate the feeling, and I haven't released this conversation yet, but Philip Sabic from Top Cow and I talked, and he said with digital comics, you don't want to cannibalize the magazine buying audience and the trade buying audience by putting that stuff out. And while I can appreciate that, I also think, and everyone knows, there's a much bigger world out there beyond our circle of friends and fans that do like this stuff to go after. And you've got to go after them with the right kind of material. And I mean, I love the old Spider-Man books, but like what Marvel has put out digitally has been very early Spider-Man. I don't know if that's going to excite a 13-year-old kid. You know, the trades as it is at DC, let's keep it in DC right now, seem to usually take at least 2 years before they're put out in trades and stuff. Again, they're very mindful of the monthly magazine business. DiDio says it all the time. We are in the periodical business. It's good that Jim is out there saying the digital market is something that we have to embrace and we have to explore. It will be interesting to see how much risk they're willing to take in terms of putting out something that can attract a bigger audience, but also not, you know, screw them over the dollars they could make from the magazines.
Right. Marvel has dabbled in that. They do have original comics.
Yes.
For digital comics, very few. But they do have, like, Jason Aaron wrote one, and I know Bob Gale's doing it right now, I think, still is doing an ongoing Amazing Spider-Man comic that is brand new that runs in conjunction with the print comic.
And that's
kind of
true.
Encourages you to go back and forth. So they're kind of experimenting with that. One place that got a lot of attention, I believe, from retailers, certainly got a lot of attention from me, was when the Spider-Woman motion comic.
Absolutely.
The each issue, quote-unquote, episode, right? I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, but I call TV episodes issues sometimes.
Oh, yeah, I do that too, absolutely.
Each Spider-Woman episode was released before the print issue. And, you know, I remember when Buckley announced that at a comic book convention, and I don't remember which one, that's terrible, but I can remember exactly where I was sitting. I think it was in New York. But he announced it, and it was, I think everybody at the panel table was like, did we really decide that? And he just came right out and said, we have to do this. We have to take a risk on this. And I think, you know, it is a fine line to walk. Do you go ahead and really try to get people to sample these digital comics and make them exciting by saying these are exclusive to you or these are before the print audience? Or do you never do that and therefore really never attract a real audience to that area and just stick to the print side? I think, you know, you kind of have to walk a fine line there. And I don't know that you know, I don't know that there's an easy answer to that, but I'm sure that's, again, another thing that as co-publishers they're wrestling with and making sure that one side does not become more important than the other, but that each side supports the characters and the stories and the, you know, the ongoing, you know, cash cow that is these comic book characters.
Did you buy both the Spider-Woman comic and the motion comics?
Did I?
Yeah.
No.
Okay. I bought the first few. I'll admit it. I
was the first episode.
Okay.
And then I read the print.
Oh, okay.
Honestly, I'm not really into the motion comic that much. I mean, I think the best ones that I've seen are N and Spider-Woman. I think Alex Maleev, just he knows what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Out of all of them that I've seen. Again, my opinion, I think, you know, the Watchmen one was pretty cool, and I think, you know, there's been some others that I've seen that have been pretty cool, but I like comic books. I like print comic books. That's me.
No, I agree. I guess because the story was coming out faster in digital, I watched all the motion comic episodes and felt that I did have the story, so I stopped buying the comic as
See?
A consequence. No, you're
that's,
right.
Yeah.
And that's... And
it took a risk to try and get you to really invest yourself in the motion comic, and they wanted to get you hooked on the motion comic, and it worked with you, but
at what cost? Because as opposed to spending $3.99 per issue, I spent $1.99 and got the motion comic and got the story faster. And I mean, and it also you know, motion comic is a different animal, and I certainly hope that while I have no problem with motion comics as its own animal, I hope that digital comics, much like digital books, are just, you know, comics you can read on a tablet or whatever reader, e-reader you decide.
Right.
Because that, you know, I agree with you. I think comics are its own art form, and I don't want to see it go away. And I don't want to see limited flash animation or whatever they decide to call each iteration of motion comics replace standard comic books. There is something special about that, and it is a very specific art form. You know, again, Ben Templesmith really was very eloquent about it, you know, being willing to explore it as an artist and is interested in the challenge of trying to make something specifically for motion, but saying, don't, you know, it's not a comic book anymore if it doesn't have word balloons and, you know, the panels.
It's not an interactive experience, really. It's a sit back and listen and watch experience as opposed to, you know, you are
participating.
An active participant in the story when you're reading a comic book. It's like reading a novel, but you're even more of an active participant because, you know, I don't know about you, but I sometimes pause between two panels. You just kind of have an inherent sense of that person turns their head and how much of a pause there is. You know?
Sure.
I mean, don't get me wrong. When I really, really want to get to the end, I'm tearing through that comic. But generally, your reading experience, it's very much a participatory thing. You know, you're very interactive with it. So, yeah, I think we all want to see the art form stick around. And I do think that the desire is to have the same type of experience in a digital comic that you have, you know, turning pages in a paper comic. And I think that's why people were so excited about the iPad, because it does seem to be the first time that something built for a mass market, because clearly Apple is going off after a large market.
You bet.
Is color and is the right shape and the right, you know,
size,
has the right technology, the right size for comic books. It just finally, you know, if you came up with a comic book reader that was just made to read comics, you'd come up with something pretty much like the iPad, you know.
Oh no, you're right.
Something shaped pretty much that way that you could sit down and put in your lap and push a couple buttons and, you know, turn the pages and with your finger. You know, you would totally want to turn the page with your finger and maybe zoom in with your fingers. You would build this almost the exact same thing. So I think that's why everybody's so excited about it, is it's really the first device that just feels right for comics. Whether or not they'll go anywhere on there, I don't know. I know Marvel was disappointed.
Yeah, and I find that interesting.
Well, I think because they had put so much time and energy into Flash, and their online initiative is built around that, and you can't you can't run Flash on the iPad. So I think that was part of it. And I think, you know, there were some other things. I think they had higher expectations for some of it. So.
Well, I'm glad you brought.
I think everybody else I talked to was really excited about the iPad.
But I'm glad you brought up Flash, because I think that is something that if you're, you know, other than Apple, 80%. I mean, I don't know the exact percentage, but it certainly seems like most of
it's a problem.
It is a problem.
On the iPhone. It really starts kicking me off after a while.
Well, but that's what I mean, and that's what kind of took the wind out of my sails with the iPad as well. In terms of what do you mean they're not, you know, going to have Flash? I mean, that's I'm sorry, I'm one of those late adapters that does find other things than the I still don't own an iPod. I've been very content with the MP3 players that I've bought through the years that, you know, aren't Apple oriented and everything. And,
well, I understand,
you know,
but you have to recognize that MP3 players in general, each time that there's a major leap forward, a lot of times it's Apple leading the pack.
Very true.
Granted,
absolutely.
They may be a little cocky about, you know, but I think, you know, that's in order to sell a higher end product.
You're absolutely right.
The vast majority of their products are a higher end product, so they have to be a little. They have to have a little. Well, we're better attitude, because I mean, usually it is better. But yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, it is fairly infuriating when I'm on a website and somebody goes, "Look, a new trailer for whatever," and I go, "Sweet," and I can't play it because it's Flash.
There you go.
But it's really not. It's not that tough to find it on YouTube usually.
Oh, I understand. Let's look at the examples though of Betamax and VHS, HD DVD and Blu-ray DVD. I mean, that's the thing. The better technology doesn't always win.
No, you're right. I think, you know, we'll see what happens with the iPad.
Sure.
Whatever happens, I mean, they have opened the door to tablets, and I think a lot of people are going to be making them now. I think without a doubt, tablets are going to be the thing for a while. Whether or not they catch on, whether or not they become the thing that we all think they're going to be, I don't know. Me personally, I have a MacBook Air. I already basically have a two-sided tablet. I own one. I just don't have a touch screen, so I am all ready to pick that thing up. I want it.
I understand, and I know a lot. I could tell you a lot of people in Chicago, a lot of comic book fans that are itching for this and already are in their head thinking of all the comic books they'll be buying digitally as opposed to, you know, magazine anymore. And, you know.
It's kind of scary, isn't it?
Well, you know, and again, another quote from Hickman. He said, there's going to be a lot of blood in the water this year.
Yeah. You know, but again, I don't know. You know, I talk to the really small guys, like Third World, for example, because I love Mike DeVito over there. They, you know, there's also a lot of opportunity.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, granted, I can see where, you know, the major publishers are afraid of the blood in the water, but, you know, these teeny little fish.
You bet.
They're liking this opportunity.
Oh, hell yeah.
To reach this audience, because suddenly they have as much of an opportunity to reach Joe Sixpack as the next guy. I mean, to some extent. Obviously,
no, you're
Spider-Man
absolutely right.
Has a huge advantage because it's Spider-Man. But, you know, I hate to use this example because she's one of my favorite Marvel characters, but Kitty Pryde is not a household name. And so I'm trying to think a third. Well, like Stuff of Legend has as much of a chance as,
yes,
you know, Mouse Guard, as whatever, as, you know,
Atomic Robo. There's tons of
on an even playing field when it comes to the iPad. If they can get on there, they may have as much of an opportunity to be the next Spider-Man,
and also
or the next Calvin and Hobbes, or the next, you know, what I can't think of something in mainstream, but you know, something like Calvin and Hobbes.
Sure.
For a while, I mean, everybody had a Calvin and Hobbes collection, you know, on their coffee table or in their bathroom, quite frankly. And I mean, it was everywhere. It was commonplace.
Well, look at how
that character was recognizable. Well, any of these comic book companies could come up with something like that if they had a way to reach people the way that Calvin and Hobbes used to reach people in the daily newspaper. That doesn't exist anymore, and it certainly doesn't exist for comic books. But if the iPad offered that some way to team up with in the New York Times, you touch that little box in the top right corner and you get your Mouse Guard comic, you know, or whatever, There's just so much opportunity. Obviously, that would be huge for any comic book to be in the New York Times. But any, you know, something on the iPad, some opportunity. There's all kinds of opportunity there for the little guys. So
definitely. I mean, who's to say that, you know, the same little girls that went nuts for manga wouldn't find, like, Strangers in Paradise or something? You know, a soap opera right. comic book could make it. Or, I mean, that's the thing. Beyond superheroes and licensing that the big two are so concerned about, you know, a good soap opera comic, a good crime comic or something, you're right. If they find the right partner and can get awareness through an audience, the sky's the limit for these small publishers that were thrilled to get 5,000, you know, copies sold. And,
exactly.
you know, there's a huge market that's waiting that's never experienced their stuff. No, I totally agree. And this is a great thing. And that's why, as critical as I am of Apple and the iPad and stuff, you're right. They are always the ones to break through and come out with that first, you know, product that does allow the rest to follow. So, no, this is all a good thing. And you're right. It does kind of inform what's happening again with DC Entertainment. And I'm glad we've kind of broadened the discussion as well to talk about some of these other things.
You and I can get off on any tangent. No, but it does. I think there's a new importance given. DC Entertainment gives a new importance to digital comics. It gives a new importance to movies and television. I think we could sit here and talk about movies, TV, video games, toys, digital comics, and still be talking about DC Entertainment, because that's what it's all about.
Yep.
That's why it's not called DC Comics anymore. It's the whole reason that it's, you know, that it happened. But what's really cool, I mean, I don't think we came right out and said this. I mean, I think I kind of skirted around it there. But what's really cool is these are comic guys.
Yep.
You know, I think everybody expected this publisher was going to be some dude from Warner Brothers.
A suit. Yeah.
Oh, I expected it. But it's Jim Lee, you know, and Dan DiDio. I mean, you got his voice down. We know these guys, you know, so... I mean, it's very cool, and I we've already talked, you know, already given Jeff Johns a big head if he ever listens.
Absolutely.
To but these are guys, you know, that we have respect for within the industry, and I think it's kind of cool that it's some of our own, and I think that's why there was an initial very positive response from the comic book industry, and I think even later as everybody stepped back and looked at it as a big picture thing. Still felt pretty good about it, you know.
No, and I think both the advances in technology are making for new creative platforms for artists and writers that we respect to you know tackle new mediums, and I think that's a good thing. And I think the new mediums will only benefit from their creativity, and also the fact that the suits that you know have the bank accounts that are going to make these things possible are listening to the right creative people. And it seems like after so many decades of, you know, failures and near misses and, you know, decent TV shows that end too soon or, you know, ones that peter out that never have anything follow up on them and stuff, that there seems to be a game plan now for both the big two and the smaller companies as well. And the reason why I do this podcast is because technology allows me to try something different than, you know, the radio paradigm that I've been in for 20 plus years. And, you know, that's why I'm here. It's exciting opportunities. And I think it's great that everyone else is getting the chance. And the good news is that the fans are the ones that are going to benefit the most from this, because we're going to get very cool things that we're all going to be very excited about that will continue to exploit the characters that we like. And new stories will come from these new mediums as well.
Very well said.
Seriously, I thank you for doing this, because, you know, we always have fun talking at cons, and this is the kind of conversation we usually have when we're sitting
we
in a
do.
Coffee shop. Exactly.
We sit up and do this. Little do people know that this is very normal for you.
Exactly. But no, really, people are thrilled to hear you, as I said at the start of the conversation. So, you know, you're always welcome back, and I'm sure I'll be bugging you in a few months as these things continue to develop, both at the big two and as the smaller companies respond. Again, the blood in the water, we didn't even talk about, you know, we said Comixology, but there's Panelfly, there's Graphically, there's Longbox, and, you know, all these companies that are starting to come out, these digital platforms, to help some of these smaller publishers and hopefully get the big publishers interested in them as well. It's going to be very interesting to see how all this shakes out.
It is, and I can't help thinking that it's all going to come down to one place where you get your comics, and I don't know who that one place is going to be. I don't know if it's going to be iBooks, you know, or whatever comics, or I don't know if it's one of these going to be one of these guys that you mentioned, or who it's going to be, or maybe it won't be just one place. Maybe you do need to go to three or four different places to find your comics, or maybe the comics are available in any of those places. I don't know, but I can't help thinking it's all going to shake down and be similar to what happened with iTunes kind of taking over the marketplace.
That's true. But I also wonder if, you know, is there room the way Amazon is able to sell music? And I don't know how well Amazon does it. I mean, it certainly doesn't do the iTunes numbers, but it can't hurt. And,
right, yeah.
You know, it'll be very interesting. Not to mention, you know, the ability to sell these products digitally as well as at their own websites and everything. Well, very cool, Vanita. No, thanks for your help, and we'll look forward to more columns in Newsarama. And like
more.
Attagirl. And
more on DC Entertainment. And I certainly hope that if we would talk again in a year, I would have a lot more insight on what those guys are doing.
And, yeah, I hope to see you at a con. I know that your schedule's getting tougher, and the kids are at activity years and everything, so it's that much tougher to get away for a weekend and everything. So I hope to see you at a convention.
Yeah, it is tough. Yeah, we'll see each other soon, I'm sure.
Excellent. That's Vanita Rogers. Don't forget to follow her stories at Newsarama.com, and I thank her for her time tonight. We'll be talking more with Vanita in the months ahead. And as a side note, I've heard more about the whole HTML5 versus Flash debate, and I understand the frustrations with the people that continue to improve technology with Flash. So clearly, this is a techie issue that I don't know a lot about. If they tell me HTML5 is the way of the future, then who am I to disagree? That'll do it for this episode of Word Balloon, brought to you by C2E2, the Chicago Comics and Entertainment Expo, coming to McCormick Place in downtown Chicago, April 16th through the 18th. Don't forget, for your chance to win tickets and exclusive C2E2 merchandise before the big weekend, including one amazing VIP package, one lunch with a Marvel editor, 3 weekend passes, 5 exclusive C2E2 posters signed by creator and guest of honor Alex Ross, and 15 limited edition C2E2 t-shirts. Entering the contest is easy. Visit c2e2.com/wordballoon. Enter your name and email, and that's all it takes. We'll be drawing the winners of the entries on March 19th. Thanks again for listening. John Suntress reminding you to look for Word Balloon all over the internet. Of course, wordballoon.com. Come and check out our archive of well over 300 interviews with comic creators, animation people, people from film, television, you name it. If it's pop culture, we're talking about it here at Word Balloon. Follow me on Twitter, John Word Balloon, or on Facebook under my name, John Suntress. Questions or comments about the show, there is the Word Balloon message board. Click on the link at wordballoon.com. In fact, we have a thread up there soliciting questions for Jeff Loeb. They'll be coming back for a new Loeb report later on for Word Balloon. More interviews on the way. Make sure you check them out. Questions about the show, you can reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com. Thanks for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2010.